Hello, and welcome to the Reason Roundtable. I'm Peter Suderman, filling in for Matt Welch, who is so many time zones away that he might as well be on another planet. Joining me today are my regular co-panelists, Nick Gillespie and Catherine Mengu Ward, as well as special guest, Eric Boehm. Everyone, say hello.
Howdy.
Hello.
Happy Monday, Peter.
On this week's episode, we'll talk about the unusual, unexpected outcome of last week's midterm election, what went right, what went wrong, and what we still don't know. Plus, what Elon Musk's Twitter takeover tells us about the state of the internet and free speech online in 2022. All right, gang, it has been almost a full week since the midterm election, and we still don't know the final results. But this much is clear. Republicans radically underperformed. The red wave that was predicted turned out to be a sad low tide. And that is why I'm going to call this segment Better Dead Than Red. The GOP leader in the House, Kevin McCarthy, had predicted a huge pickup of 60 seats. He had like a whole party ready where he was going to celebrate this, and he just didn't even ever get up to the podium at all, or like came up at 2 a.m. and was like, oh, we'll have a majority by tomorrow. That didn't happen. A 60-seat pickup would have given Republicans a commanding majority. But as of this morning, Republicans still have not definitively taken control of the House. While they are favored to do so, it's likely that they will end up with a slim majority, perhaps just a few seats. Democrats, meanwhile, will hold control of the Senate and possibly even pick up a seat. Joe Biden has been doing what amounts to a victory tour, with Democrats and their partisans feeling vindicated. Democrats feel like they won the argument. That democracy was on the ballot, that abortion was on the ballot, that Medicare and Social Security were at risk, that MAGA forces had taken over the Republican Party, and that the GOP was too crazy, too extreme, and too Trumpy to be trusted. In short, Joe Biden's come on, man, kind of won. And that happened despite the fact that voters typically turn against the party of a first-term president during a midterm. It happened despite surveys that continued to show that voters didn't much like Biden and his fellow Democrats either. Inflation and the economy were the top priorities for voters, and Republicans had the edge on those issues. As Amy Walter, the editor of the Cook Political Report, tweeted, we saw poll after poll showing Democrats winning among voters who rate Biden somewhat unfavorably. That's not happened before. In five midterms for which Pew Research had data, somewhat disapprovers have never been this supportive of the president's party. Along the same lines, the AP Votecast survey found that people who identify as independents favored Democrats by 4 points. So, Nick, you wrote a book about independence, I've heard. And my first question goes to you. It's simply
a vague recollection.
It's simply
that.
What happened here? Why did voters stick with Democrats despite rating Biden's performance on key issues so poorly?
Yeah. And it's, you know, I certainly was expecting a massive increase of at least 35 seats in the House just based on past examples of this type of stuff. I mean, really, you know, and the best explanation, I think, is that people are tired of swinging from one extreme to another, which has been the mainstay of the 21st century, where a party gets 2 or 4 years in office and gets voted out because they actually perform, they follow through on what they say they want to do, and people are enough already, we want the other party. I think what happened here is that the Republicans put forward an alternative that was not even what they were doing, 4 years ago. It was extreme in the sense of a lack of seriousness, no actual agenda other than being anti-Biden. And the most prominent candidates for, Republicans were running, particularly in Senate races and things like that, were absolutely inexperienced. I mean, they did not take politics seriously. But, you know, when you look at even somebody like J.D. Vance in Ohio, who won his Senate seat, had no experience. Blake Masters, absolutely no experience. Herschel Walker, no experience. Mehmet Oz, no experience. And that trickled through. And people don't want to replace bad policy with bad policy with no experience. And I think when you layer on top of that questions about abortion, you see the voters being like, no, you know what? We want abortion to be legal. We might want it to be rare, but we don't want that. And then I think the other thing that's interesting to me is that the secretaries of state, you know, and this is the question of was democracy on the ballot. I think that's overplayed, but it's fascinating that the only secretary of state candidate who was a true election denier, who said that Trump won the election, you know, in 2016 and won in 2020 and won office was Chuck Gray of Wyoming out of a handful of people. I think people are saying we don't want the extreme of the Republican Party. And that's what was on the ballot this time. I don't think this is an embrace of Joe Biden or the Democratic agenda, which remains deeply unpopular. But what we're seeing, instead of like an unstable majority and a pendulum swinging, you know, in a wide arc, people are starting to say, no, you know what, we want something that's a little bit more serious and a little less nuts. And that's not moderation necessarily, but it is reality.
Eric, to Nick's point, how much of this is a result of Democrats winning the argument versus maybe Republicans losing it or not even bothering to make an argument at all? So Democrats are crowing about how voters bought, you know, their line about, you know, democracy and abortion and Medicare and Social Security, all that stuff's on the ballot, right? But you wrote a piece about how in the run-up to the 2020 presidential election, Republicans didn't even bother to offer a new platform. And this year, Mitch McConnell actually got mad at one of his fellow Republican senators, Senator Rick Scott, for putting out really a fairly vague proposed Republican agenda. So how much of this was just that Republicans weren't putting forth an argument, you know, like a positive vision that voters could embrace?
Yeah, I think that's a huge part of it. Political scientists talk about elections as being either choices or referendums, right? Like we have referendum elections, we have choice elections. Midterms frequently, almost always, are referendums, right? Especially first-term midterms is typically a referendum on the president's party and the party that's in power. And I think it is based on that sort of historical trend that we had this expectation of a red wave because President Joe Biden is unpopular. The Democrats have been in charge for 2 years and are generally pretty unpopular with voters. But this election, it turns out, I don't think was a referendum. I think this election was a choice election. And that's why we see sort of like scattershot results here that don't lend themselves easily to any narrative. We didn't get the red wave, but you did have Republicans win in many places. You also had results that really cut against that. And I think that's because, it was ultimately a choice election and Republicans did a poor job of making the argument for their half of that choice, right? For their option on the ballot. I think because they wrongly assumed that this was going to be an election in which people were just going to go in and vote against Democrats and against Joe Biden. There was a moment, and I led the piece that I wrote about this with this moment, but that was on Fox News the other day. Jesse Waters, who is, you know, not necessarily the most brilliant political
deep
mind,
thinker. Deep
right?
Thinker.
Not exactly a deep thinker, but he had this moment. I happened to be flipping through the cable news channels on Wednesday, the day after the election, and there was this moment where he just, I think, pulled a sort of profound thought out of the milieu of cable news. And he said that there's just not a, you know, there's not the hatred for Joe Biden out there that there is for the Clintons. There's not a hate Biden vote out there. And I think that is pretty much exactly right. Republicans have banked on the anti-Barack Obama, the anti-Hillary Clinton vote for their successes recently. And they've not put forth their own governing agenda. They've not put forth even the most basic thing, like you were talking about, that Rick Scott proposed, they've relied purely on that backlash, I hate the guy in charge vote. And that wasn't there this time. It was a choice election and Republicans failed.
Catherine, the corollary to this is that Republicans did have a good election in one key state, Florida, where Ron DeSantis and the Florida GOP absolutely clocked their Democratic rivals. So DeSantis is obviously a culture warrior, gotten a lot of attention for kind of culture war grandstanding, but he's also a governor with a record as an executive. And Florida voters seem pretty happy overall with that record. What does that tell us about this election specifically, but also about the future of the Republican Party and sort of where all of this is going, what's going to happen in 2024?
You know, I think I find myself in a position that surprisingly I have in common with many Americans. That's not always the case when it comes to electoral outcomes, which is that I think that DeSantis's victory, while I don't like his governance particularly, and I really don't like his rhetoric, I think that his victory is probably an okay sign for America. And I don't quite know what to do with that. So what I mean to say is that because a lot of the MAGA candidates got shellacked because of everything that Eric just said and Nick just said about what I think these results say about our relationship as a country to Joe Biden's presidency and the Democratic Party generally, you know, I think DeSantis is coming across as neither of those things. He is neither the thing that Joe Biden and the Democratic Party is, nor is he Trump. And so him winning and being so popular, I am choosing to read, at least, as just on the very, very basic level, Americans do not want those other two things. And if this is what's on offer, they'll take it. So I do not read it particularly as a referendum on his conduct as governor, although I'm sure for many people it was. I see it more as a not this, not that. Let's try something else. And I always think that is a healthy impulse in the American public because the two major options are bad. And this is voters recognizing that. And I appreciate it.
Frank Luntz, the kind of political messaging guru, hosted a panel of 15 Florida voters for The New York Times recently. And the headline that came out of it was, "These 15 Florida voters think Ron DeSantis is going places, like it or not." And so even the Democrats, even the progressives who he talked to, really felt like DeSantis was pushing forward and was sort of making a name for himself and was, achieving a kind of visibility nationally that was going to make him the future in some ways. Representative Peter Meyer of Michigan, who was one of these Republicans who Democrats funded, a kind of more Trumpy MAGA primary challenger, and Peter Meyer lost as a result. Peter Meyer, of course, was just
in the primary, right?
So was out. And then, of course, the Trumpy challenger also lost the election. Meyer was, of course, the successor to Justin Amash in Justin Amash's district. Peter Meyer told The New York Times, quote, "We need DeSantis. That should be lit up in neon and projected onto the side of the RNC. So, Nick, is Ron DeSantis the future of the Republican Party? And do you think the ascent of DeSantis is good or bad for libertarians?
Yeah, so those are very distinct questions, right? And I don't think we can say anything about how Ron DeSantis is going to play nationally. Very popular governor because Florida has been doing well since he's been governor. And, you know, and it's worth remembering that he got into office like by the barest of majorities. I mean, he was in a really tight race. So his win is gigantic. Like, you know, he's just he has a mandate, you know, in Florida now. But we've seen that before. It's in different circumstances. But people like Jeb Bush, who was a very popular Florida government, didn't really do much on a national stage. He had been out of office for a number of years, so it's a little bit different. He was older. You know, DeSantis is young, vibrant, and coming off of this win. But I think if we're going to ask that question, then we also have to ask, is Gavin Newsom the future of the Democratic Party? Because he has won extremely, you know, big elections. He survived a recall in California and has, you know, national ambitions. Jared Polis in Colorado walked to victory and represents a different type of governance than I think either DeSantis or Newsom. So I don't know. I mean, I don't think we can say anything about how what DeSantis plays on a national stage. It's also not fully clear. I mean, is Trump still the main thing, you know, the main guy in the Republican Party? Supposedly a day after we record this is going to announce that he's running for president, and we'll see. I do think it's really important to note that, you know, the Trump candidates and the guy in Michigan who unseated Peter Meyer, who had, you know, basically scared off Justin Amash, you know, lost big because he is exactly the type of candidate that Trump and Trump Republicans tend to back, which is somebody with little or no experience, little or no, reality testing skills, and they're going to lose. Is DeSantis good or bad for libertarians? I think on net, he is, it's a mixed bag and probably bad, or rather, I would like to see us do better. If you get a DeSantis who is pretty good, you know, he was good on COVID, pretty good on school choice, but then terrible on, you know, on these kind of CRT laws and a variety of other culture war activities, he is awful. And we can't settle for that. Would he be better than Gavin Newsom as president? Absolutely.
I recently heard a friend describe DeSantis as a representative of the new fusionism, which is the culture,
the new fusionism,
which is culture war grandstanding to keep people sort of to get attention, combined with relatively competent, you know, like executive administration and governance. And
I think there's something to that. But with DeSantis, the things, and this is the shift from, you know, state to, you know, to national stuff. What is his policy on immigration? What is his policy on free trade? What is his foreign policy? And those are major, major issues that will change the way independents certainly view him, but also Republicans, also Democrats.
Well, and isn't this, I mean, this to me is the concern with DeSantis. He has demonstrated clear authoritarian type impulses on some of the issues that he has chosen to kind of foreground. He also has demonstrated that he is willing to make everything part of the culture war. That's his winning formula. And so, you know, I think the answer to what is his immigration policy isn't going to be, well, he has thought deeply about the trade-offs for the American economy and, you know, where the constitutional lines lie for the limits of his power. And then he's going to kind of come up with a policy based on what he thinks would be the best. No, it's going to be, is shouting about this in a certain way going to win me an election? Great. I will shout about it in that way. And so in that sense, I think even what you said in your earlier answer, Nick, is I'm not sure it's true that DeSantis will be better for, you know, people who kind of hold libertarian views than, say, a Newsom presidency. And that's just because I don't think we know what his policies are beyond whatever the culture war filter strains out as a winning strategy. And I just think that's worth really clearly caveating when we say, like, he's done some things we don't hate. He has. He's done some things we don't hate, but that's no guarantee that he will do them in the future.
I absolutely agree. I do think, you know, when you look at COVID, he was right and he was following a logic there that was important. And also, you know, if the model of governance is between high taxes and promised high services, you know, which is California and Gavin Newsom, or lower taxes, lower regulation in general, and lower levels of services, you know, I think that's a meaningful choice. And DeSantis has an edge from a libertarian perspective. And I say that as somebody who is totally repulsed by virtually everything about him.
His immigration policy.
Can't we just have Jared Polis for president?
All right. So let's.
I think that's a, you know, it's a real question. And also, when Polis goes to the national stage, he won't be as libertarian as we like to see in certain aspects of his government.
I'm more willing to be disappointed by the Polis in the ways I think Polis will disappoint me than I am to be disappointed by either Newsom or DeSantis in the ways I think they will disappoint me. And if that isn't my politics in a nutshell, I don't know what is.
Yeah, all of these people.
I also just add another thing, if we may, about like when governors leave their state and go national. I was talking with people the other night about Chris Christie. And remember, there was a Chris Christie moment where he was he just seemed real and great and wonderful. And I was a columnist for Time at the moment. And I write, like, there's no fucking way Chris Christie is going to make it outside of New Jersey. He's perfect for New Jersey. And as I've bored everybody with, I know New Jersey well because I grew up there. And it was absolutely true. What worked to make him a kind of media star in New Jersey in the New York media area meant he was poisoned outside. And, you know, there's a Florida man dimension to Ron DeSantis that might really not play well once you creep north of, you know, the Florida.
I think the DeSantis-Christie comparison is an interesting one, but also it's not just Christie, even though he's probably the best example of that. But like, what governor in recent history has had a good presidential run when they've tried to make that jump, right? There are so many disappointments on that list, Jeb and Christie and Greg Abbott. And I mean, it's like
Mitt Romney, George Bush is the last one.
But
right?
Since him, it's been senators that become president that have sort of a national brand and a national name recognition, or, you know, people like Donald Trump, who have huge name recognition. Governors, I think, do kind of get buttonholed into, like, or pigeonholed, I should say, into like being from a particular place. And that makes them somewhat unpalatable to people who are not from that place.
It's, you know, it's also kind of fascinating when you think about this in the future of the Republican Party, like Doug Ducey, who was term limited out in Arizona, you know, very conservative socially and whatnot, but looser and less culture wary on these issues. But like, no, I don't know what his plans are. Nobody is talking about him except that he, you know, it was nice knowing him and he's kind of dead. And that's kind of curious to think about that, to be the leader of the Republican Party, you really have to be a Trumpian figure. You have to be a loudmouth and somebody who is very engaged in culture war issues, whatever else you're doing.
So I do want to switch focus to the Democrats here, and in fact, to a senator. This weekend, Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren of She Has a Plan for That had an op-ed in the New York Times titled, "Democrats Just Held the Senate, Here's What We Do Next." What we do next turned out to be a lot more of the same. More spending, more taxation, more spending. Did I mention more spending? Basically, it was an argument that Democrats would take Biden's big government approach that he has had over the last couple of years and run with it, expand on it. So, Eric, do you agree with Warren? I mean, do you think that that is what's going to happen? What should we expect if not?
Well, that's tough to say, but I will say, let me start by saying something positive about this. I appreciate that Elizabeth Warren is talking about policy a couple of days after an election, right? And I think you can sort of pair this piece with the Mitt Romney op-ed that was in the Wall Street Journal last week, where he said another thing that I agree with, which is like, hey, Republicans, maybe we should actually have an agenda. Maybe we should talk about, liberalizing trade and opening up immigration. And maybe we should have an actual platform that we can take to voters. And so I think those two, as the sort of figures of their party that are going to be interested in making a policy argument, they will get shouted down and we will get into the presidential campaign and everyone will forget about that in like maybe 2 months. But there is maybe a brief window of time where both parties can kind of have a little opportunity here to move the ball forward on their respective agendas. I think Elizabeth Warren is vastly overstating the extent to which Democrats got any sort of mandate here. It's the same thing that they misunderstood 2 years ago, which is they had a 50-50 Senate and they happened to have the vice president. And they took that to mean, oh, the voters have given us the authority to do whatever we want. That's obviously not true. It looks like they're definitely going to have at least 50 plus Kamala Harris. And they may have 51, depending on the result in Georgia, but it's still going to be a situation like we've been in for the last couple of years where Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema and a couple other members of the Democratic caucus in the Senate are going to have a tremendous amount of power to influence what can actually get done. And then, of course, you have the fact that the Republicans control the House. So, I mean, I don't know. I don't see Congress really doing much of anything on these big issues in the next few years, except I hope that maybe we can talk about stuff like entitlement reform, maybe, like things that both parties have to agree on to get accomplished and things that need to get done in the next decade before everything goes to hell.
Catherine, this will not be a total loss for Republicans if they manage to retake the House, which is likely, not quite certain, but quite likely as of this morning. And that will give us, as Eric said, that will give us divided government with a Republican check on Biden and Senate Democrats. So at minimum, that should end the kind of partisan spending bills we saw over the last couple of years. Libertarians are often fans of divided government. You're a libertarian. You love divided government, right? This is exciting for you. Big moment.
You know, I used to be a skeptic of this theory, as I think I've said on this podcast. Even for my cold little robot heart, it always struck me as a little bit too cynical that our best case scenario was just like a bunch of stumble bunnying around because no one can get anything done. And it turned out that I was too optimistic and that I should have embraced this theory from the beginning. I think divided government is good, though I think our recent experiment in divided government has shown that the benefit might actually be in checking the internal kind of desire to go big on the part of each party that only holds a very, very narrow majority. That actually, to me, was the upside of this last couple of years. It wasn't, oh, the Republicans are stopping the Democrats from doing bad things and vice versa. It was when you only have 51 votes, when you only have the bare majority for your party, you have to get internal agreement in your party. And that's the moderating force. And I think that reflects a thing that I've always believed, which is that, you know, in the spectrum of any given party, most of the people aren't insane. I know that it's, you know, these days we have a lot of affective polarization and that we have this notion that somehow we are going to, you know, if we can only vanquish the bad guys with a different color on their bumper stickers, that then good will be done. When in fact, I think most people who vote for most parties, and even in fact, most people who hold office under the auspices of most parties, are relatively reasonable and trying to do the right thing. And that creating this very, very narrow majority is a moderating force for good. I wouldn't believe that if we were moderating, you know, libertarian impulses, right? Like I am ultimately, you know, I want to see fairly revolutionary changes. I want to see big difference in the way that we do government from the way we do government right now. Failing that being on the menu, though, I kind of like this version of divided government in which the parties are checked internally by their own tiny margins.
So one last thing I want to ask about here, Nick, is something that Eric mentioned. One of the last undecided races is in Georgia, where Senate candidates Herschel Walker and Raphael Warnock will go to a runoff since neither of them got 50% of the vote. There was another candidate on the ballot this time, Libertarian Chase Oliver, who got just over 2% of the vote. And now both sides are blaming him for spoiling the race. So are libertarians playing spoiler here? Is that what's happening? Is it really Chase Oliver's fault?
It is absolutely, you know, that a sitting, you know, senator couldn't get 50% of the vote, you know, only because of a libertarian and an inexperienced, incompetent Republican candidate basically tied him. Again, not with 50% of the vote. It's obviously libertarians are spoilers here. What I think is most interesting about the race in Georgia is that I think it encapsulates Georgia is an interesting state where it's, you know, it's not really purple, but there are hard, you know, defined parts that are red, defined parts that are blue. And neither, you know, this is where the country is. When you look at exit polling, independents are split down the middle in terms of the party, you know, that they have more preference for and things like that. So I think Georgia in a lot of ways is exactly where the country is. And what is good about this and the way that Chase Oliver is talking about this is he wants to have public conversations with each of the candidates before he says, hey, you know what, like I'm not in the runoff, but like this person has either promised to do something that's in a libertarian, you know, frame of mind or something like that. I like that a lot. I think this also shows, and this is something that Matt and I talked about in the Declaration of Independence, the party that adopts a couple of key libertarian elements and goes with them, and they can even stack them on their existing stupid piles of crap that they're going to do because the Republicans or Democrats, is going to win. The country has been split. I mean, this is the thing that we need to keep, you know, hammering home. Neither party has a stable majority because they don't have messages or policies or attitudes or mindsets that people, you know, a majority of Americans want. If you go with a libertarian message, whether it's about, you know, gay marriage and lifestyle freedom, whether it's about marijuana and other drug legalization, whether it's immigration, you name it, stuff that people care about in super majorities, you are going to be you're going to win every race that you want to be in. So I'm looking forward to how that plays out, particularly the conversation and like whether or not Oliver actually endorses one candidate or another for the runoff.
All right. As the final element in our elections discussion, I want to go around the panel and have everyone name one, just one, only one, one good thing and one, only one, again, only one bad thing about the midterm here. So it can be a specific race, a ballot initiative, a narrative, a trend line, some sort of argument, just one good thing and one bad thing that came out of this as you see it. Catherine, let's go to you first.
My one good thing I already mentioned, which is Jared Polis's success. Yeah. I really honestly, in my pessimistic heart of hearts, thought, you know, he at this point, I would say, is the only politician actually holding office that I even moderately like at this point. And he won. That's great. He won big. He won for the right reasons, as far as I can tell, you know, polling aside. So that's my good news. My bad news actually is I have always been a big fan of election betting markets you know, have, in fact, I think made secondary bets on the efficacy of betting markets over the years. They did not do well in this election. They did not perform well. And John Stossel actually has a little kind of mea culpa column up on the site about this because he is also a big fan. And in fact, I think even runs or helped set up electionbettingodds.com, which tracks a bunch of those. I still think betting markets are good and a useful tool, but I was sad at how badly they performed in this cycle.
Eric?
I'm going to cheat and sort of copy off Catherine here, but it's a little bit bigger than just Jared Polis, right? It's Colorado in general is the good news here. Polis won by almost 20 points, but then look, the third congressional district, Lauren Boebert, who's one of these like super Trumpy members of Congress, very nearly lost. It looks now like she's going to pull it out by less than half a point, but she nearly lost to what's basically a blue dog Democrat. These people all went extinct over the last couple of decades, but here's a guy, Adam Frisch, who was talking about like cutting the deficit and cutting spending, and he's running as a Democrat, and he almost took down a hardcore MAGA Republican in Western Colorado. That's great. Look at the ballot initiatives in Colorado, too. This is a state that just reelected a Democratic governor by 20 points, but the people voted on one of the initiatives to cut the state income tax rate. Hey, that's great. They also voted to legalize some types of mushrooms and other psychedelic drugs. And there was a third ballot initiative that I was excited about, too. And I think I've lost that one. Oh, they allow wine sales in grocery and convenience stores. Like, this is all the stuff that libertarians want is all happening in Colorado at once.
Not all the stuff that we want, but literally
maybe not all the stuff.
That's
many
I mean,
good
that's
things.
It, right? Just the wine in grocery and convenience stores. I'm good.
Finally.
All of these things are exciting that they're all happening together.
Like the founders
and if
want
Democrats
it.
Want to win races in places that aren't the two coasts, they should look at what people are voting for in Colorado because there's probably a sign there. The negative is the fact that, and we touched on this a little bit earlier too, the fact that like so many of these basically unelectable, hard MAGA Republican candidates that were boosted by Democrats in the primary, so many of them lost because I think going forward, I mean, I'm happy that they lost, but going forward, I think that teaches both parties a really bad lesson. And I think we will see that same sort of shenanigans happen more and more, which is unfortunate and probably bad for the country and for like democracy in general.
I really only got two good things. And one I mentioned before, which is that the secretary, I'm losing the negative. The Secretary of State's, you know, who were denying the veracity of the election results. The 2020 election was like the most vetted election in American history. There was not widespread, significant, systematic, you know, voter fraud. The election results were pretty goddamn solid. And the people who were running against that all lost with one exception. I think that's good news. The other good news is that abortion ballot initiatives did really well because it turns out, you know, what Dan Quayle had said back in 88 when he was running as George H.W. Bush's presidential contender, and Bush himself, when he became Reagan's vice president, flip-flopped after, you know, talking about being pro-choice to become staunchly anti-abortion. Dan Quayle admitted that, like, he is against abortion, but if his daughters got pregnant, he would want that as an option. That's what we're seeing everywhere. And I still think that abortion should be settled at the national level. I think it is a fundamental right. But it's good to see people recognizing that you don't want the government making medical decisions, and that ultimately what it is. So I just have two good things.
All right. Well, I have a good news and a bad news, and in some ways they're the same. The good news is that Republicans lost, and in particular, Trumpy MAGA maniac types lost. And while I don't know that everyone in the Republican Party is going to learn the right lessons from that, I think, or at least I hope some will, and it will probably have a salutary effect on the Republican Party. But the corollary, the flip side of that is the bad news is that Democrats won, and they won on some really tendentious, irritating arguments. And as Eric said, they also won in part by cynically boosting really awful Trumpy MAGA inexperienced candidates. And that strategy worked. And I think they are going to learn some very bad, very unfortunate lessons from that. Okay. Before we go on, let's stop for just a bit and say that this show is sponsored by BetterHelp. You ever wish life came with a user manual? Like a YouTube help video, you know, when you don't know how to fix your dishwasher, but for you and your brain and your feelings? Unfortunately, life doesn't come with a user manual. So when it's not working for you, it's normal to feel stuck. Navigating life's challenges can make you feel uncertain, whether it's a career change, a new relationship, hosting a podcast on Monday morning when you don't really know what you're supposed to be saying. Therapists are trained to help you figure out the cause of challenging emotions and learn productive coping skills, which makes therapy the closest thing to a guided tour of the complex engine called you. As the world's largest therapy service, BetterHelp has matched 3 million people with professionally licensed and vetted therapists available 100% online. Plus, it's affordable. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to match with a therapist. If things aren't clicking, you can easily switch to a new therapist anytime. It could not be simpler. No waiting rooms, no traffic, no endless searching for the right therapist. Learn more and save 10% off your first month at betterhelp.com/roundtable. That's betterhelp.com/roundtable. Okay, let's move on to this week's listener question, which comes from listener QB, who writes, Brazil is a country with over 200 million people, and they counted all of their presidential election votes on election night. U.S. Democrats, however, need weeks to count all their votes. What other explanation is this than cheating? So this is, I think, representative of a line of thinking that I've heard elsewhere. Complaints have surfaced over the last week with Tucker Carlson comparing U.S. elections unfavorably to Venezuela, of all places. And even Nancy Pelosi seemed annoyed at how long it's taking to count the votes. She told ABC News this weekend, I wish it would be faster, but it isn't. So, Eric, why is it taking so long to count the votes?
Well, it's always taken a while to count the votes, right? I think there's two responses to this. And the first one is that this sort of assumes that things used to be better in the past or something like that. I don't remember a time when we got like all the results on election day anyway. There have always been close races. Another part of it, though, has to do, and specifically the like comparison to Brazil here is interesting because Brazil uses electronic voting for all of their vote counting, which obviously speeds things up, but can be subject to shenanigans, can be subject to concerns about whether it's, you know, legit or not. And so we use in a lot of, you know, every part of the country, every state runs its own elections under its own system. But there are a lot of paper ballots. There are a lot of, you know, stuff that is counted by hand. And we're also kind of learning how to go through the mail-in vote process, which we did in 2020, and I think much more effectively this time around. But states, you know, last time, certainly a lot of states were not counting their mail-in vote until after Election Day. Some states have fixed that. To me, it's a little bit disingenuous because you hear this argument from the right frequently of like, oh, why is it taking so long for us to count votes? And why is it taking so long for the results to come in? That must be signs of fraud. When it's like the reason why a lot of states have these rules about having paper ballots and having a paper trail and not using electronic voting is also because of concerns that the right has pushed in the past about voter fraud. And they want that the paper record there. So you kind of can't have it both ways. Like if you want the results to go quickly, you can't do the hand counting.
Nick, the slowness of the count isn't just annoying. It's pretty obviously, just based on the listener's question, helping to sow distrust about politics, about our elections. Is that something you worry about? And are there voting process reforms you think we should consider to help make the vote counts go faster?
Not particularly. You know, I think that the most important thing, like when you say there is an issue, and the only thing that can explain it is what I personally believe. You know, I don't think you're going to reach that person, and I don't know that it's worth conversing with them, whether they're woke activists or voter fraud enthusiasts or whatever. The voting system works really well. As Eric was talking about, we have moved because of COVID and other reasons, which makes sense, to all sorts of voting, early voting, as well as kind of late voting and tallying and then certifying elections. There's no fraud at any significant rate, even in Republican states where they looked for it in order to reelect Donald Trump. Nobody found anything. There's really nothing to worry about here. The most important thing to recognize, and this is the message of the 21st century with the 2000 presidential election, elections are really close now because each party sucks and everybody knows it. So like more and more races are coming down to the wire. You know, the reason why Arizona is going to have to wait for a while is because Carrie Lake should have been able to win easily, but she's nuts and out to lunch. And even diehard Republicans in Arizona couldn't pull the lever for her. And they elect a kind of mediocre Democrat who is not as bad as a Democrat in California. Elections are close. It takes a while to figure out who's won. It's not complicated.
Catherine, to Eric's point, you and I were both in college in the year of our Lord 2000. And you remember probably turning on the news everywhere, like passing by the news in your like dorm hall or wherever it was, right? Like just it was kind of on in the air. And literally every other sentence was just too close to call. Too close to call. And like it became like at least where I was in at school, like it became this running gag because it was like lasted months and months. They couldn't say anything. All they could say was too close to call. So I guess it was cheating back then, right?
Yeah. I mean, I spent the election night of 2000 playing a game of Risk because we thought like, oh, by the time nice. This game of Risk is over, we'll know who
by
won the election.
By the time you're in Yakutsk, it'll
and
be decided.
It turned out. Yeah, Ukraine. But the no, I think this question asker, I disagree with Nick. I think that people, it is worth talking about this because I think that this particular subspecies of concern about election malfeasance is subject to disproof. And what Eric said is right. There's nothing new about the delay, which is highly significant. But I also think this is a really classic Hanlon's razor moment. Never attribute to malice that which can be adequately explained by stupidity. This is this is evidence that people are bad at things, not that people are part of an evil conspiracy.
But they're not bad at things. Some states have quick. Some states count the ballots ahead of time.
And the slow states that are subject to these conspiracy theories are not following best practices. They have chosen incompetence for a variety of reasons. And of course, there are bad actors. Of course, there's someone in each of these states. There's someone somewhere in the system who thinks that maybe they can, in fact, break the rules and turn this to their advantage. But those people are not, by and large, empowered by the system. And the delays are a product of screwing around, not malfeasance.
Okay. I want to move on from the elections to something that's much more important to most normal Americans. Elon Musk's Twitter and his experiment with a paid verification scheme, Twitter Blue. We're going to call this segment Even Elon Gets the Blues. Elon Musk.
Ooh.
Elon Musk implemented a new form of Twitter Blue in which users could pay for blue check verification, even if they weren't, in some cases, the person or brand they claimed to be in their account. And so the result was a lot of pure comedy. A parody account posing as the Chiquita banana brand tweeted that they had just overthrown the Brazilian government. I guess that's how we got the fast vote count. There was a fake Tesla account that tweeted, breaking, a second Tesla has hit the World Trade Center. Maybe a little too soon for that one. So not everyone thought this stuff was funny after a Washington Post report said that they were able to create a fake verified account for Democratic Senator Ed Markey. Markey wrote a sharply worded letter to Elon Musk demanding responses to a whole bunch of questions with like a deadline at the end of November. And Musk's response was just to like Twitter troll him and be like, no, I'm not going to do that. Why are you wearing a mask in your avatar? Like, why would you do that? Like, so, you know, this didn't work out. Like, at the same time, the parody stuff seemed to be posing actual problems. And late last week, the company did press pause on the Twitter Blue rollout. Over the weekend, Ben Smith's new Inside Media newsletter at Semaphore declared that even the people who thought Elon knew what he was doing are starting to have doubts. Twitter may be the most important company in the history of news, and it's off the rails. Nick, what do you think of that description? The most important company in the history of news. And does any of this worry you, right? Like, does all this drama shake your faith, if you had any, I guess, to begin with, in Musk's management abilities? Does it make you in any way concerned about the future of freedom of speech online? Like, does this sort of thing seem like it actually matters to you, or is this just funny because we got a bunch of funny tweets out?
You know, two quick things to say about it. And the first is Musk's takeover and, you know, cutting of the workforce and all of that. Everything he is doing is completely within the range of what any new owner does of a business that has been in trouble, you know, period. And everybody forgets that for the past decade, people have been saying Twitter is a shit show. It's a hellscape. It needs to be changed, blah, blah, blah. And you get somebody who actually starts doing this. There's a reason, a super fan named Ron Hayden, who was at Next, the company that Steve Jobs started after he got ousted from Apple, and then went from Next back to Apple. And Ron went with Steve Jobs, and he talked about, in a great Twitter thread, just about, you know, how what's going on at Twitter is exactly what Jobs did when he came back to Apple, which really needed an overhaul. So the reporting on this is very pointed, and it's all just anti-Musk stuff. Having said that, I think Musk will likely fail, you know, at Twitter, because it's hard to change companies and it's hard to grow them when they start to flatline and things like that. So we'll see. That worries me. I think Twitter is great. I love Twitter. I think Twitter is still funny. The larger question of will it invite government oversight? You know, that's a real question, because Ed Markey always wants to take over things. This is his, you know, his stock in trade. He's been pushing, you know, for the FCC to have control over everything, including this podcast, for his entire career. He's awful in that way. I do think that the way that Elon Musk is talking about stuff, it's going to make it more likely that the government, just to troll him, is going to start, you know, flexing more and more on social media. And that worries me for the same reason it worried me long before Musk was talking about buying Twitter.
Yeah, that's my concern as well. And this, I guess I just want to put this question to Catherine real quick here, is this is such a circus. And it's, and the circus aspect of it makes Twitter and Elon Musk a high profile target. And so my worry here is that it is going to invite regulatory oversight and scrutiny simply because Musk seems to like the fact that it is a circus, and he seems to enjoy being the ringleader. And so I am enjoying this myself as a consumer of funny tweets. But I think certain senators don't see it that way, and that this may end up drawing attention to not just to Twitter, but to online speech and online speech regulation. You know, we've got big Supreme Court cases on Section 230 coming up, and that stuff is, you know, legislatively still up in the air. Catherine, do you worry that maybe Musk is sort of making too much noise here, and that in and of itself, the noise aspect of this is going to generate attention from Congress and regulators in ways that's not going to be productive?
You know, I absolutely would have said that was a worry. I would have sort of phrased it exactly as you phrased it. As I was listening to you ask that question, though, I got mad, because that's not how it should be. It's absolutely infuriating that we live under a system where, like, being noisy attracts the attention of regulators. It's like some kind of horror movie, like that one with the Sandra Bullock and the mask or whatever. Like, I don't know. There's like, there's this idea that, like, we have to, like, keep our heads down or the regulators will come for us, and that it's entirely a product of kind of an artificial set of criteria that include media attention that would bring regulation upon you. That's messed up, man. That's not right. This has always been true, right? I mean, it was Walmart before it was Amazon. It was, you know, there's always been some brands that sort of raise the ire of regulators and that also make for good content. And so people pay attention and they get a disproportionate amount of, you know, legal and regulatory attention as a result. I will say more broadly, like, I'm out here trying to defend Elon. You know, I like the rockets, as you know. It's like when it comes to Elon, like, I'm not angry. I'm disappointed. You know, I want to, like, have a sit down with him because he has so much potential and he is squandering it. You know, I think that he is choosing to cast himself as a kind of supervillain. I agree with you that actually the biggest risk is the regulatory risk. And I think that's sort of upsetting and wrong. But I also think there's a genuine cost to, like, humanity, which is that some of his other ventures have very, very, very clear positive consequences for our future. Like, electric cars and rockets to get off this godforsaken planet are both clearly valuable. The tunnel thing, we'll see. But it's, you know, it does really strike me as a distraction. Like, I have seen the best minds of my generation. Like, Twitter has ruined them.
Starving, hysterical tweeting.
First among them.
Yeah, I think this is the case against Elon Musk's Twitter, even if it doesn't end up having any impact legislatively or sort of, you know, with regulators is just, is this really the thing that is most valuable that he could be doing with his time?
And he's allowed to waste his time. Like, I waste my time. Like, if you were like, hey, Catherine, are you using your time to better? No, I watched a bunch of Netflix last week. Like, I get it.
That's right.
But still, I want him to do more and better.
His time is his private property. That's correct. Just like Twitter now. And so he fired a bunch of people, thousands of staff, about half the staff, including a bunch of people on the misinformation and disinformation team, apparently. And I guess that's one of the concerns that that folks have is that, oh, well, because it's now understaffed, they're not going to be able to effectively police or manage misinformation on Twitter. Eric, how worried are you about Elon Musk's staffing choices at Twitter right now? Do you think this is like something that's going to impact the future of America and political discourse?
No, I don't know. Like, it's like Twitter's always been a mess. And then like the people who really care deeply about Twitter, and there's like, you know, 1/10 of 1/2 of 1% of Americans are in this category, right? Like, every time the font changes on your Twitter page or whatever, right, people freak out about it. Some people are just way too invested in like what Twitter is. Twitter is it's always been this kind of weird circus, I guess, is probably the nicest way to put it. And so no, like it'll continue to evolve and change. And it'll continue to be the source of like memes and jokes and breaking news content, which is its actual like only really useful purpose. And the other stuff, I don't know. If senators and representatives want to come like banging down Elon Musk's door to investigate him over Twitter, they're the ones who are wrong about that. That has nothing to do with Musk's decisions or the merits of them.
Think about Twitter, though. Like, if Twitter didn't exist, there's a good argument that Donald Trump wouldn't have become president.
I don't think I buy that either. I don't think it's anywhere near as influential as people think it is. I think
about
the people who are in the Twitter bubble overstate its
importance. No, but it's not. The Twitter bubble leaked into, you know, the legacy media. He was also huge on Facebook. So social media platforms.
It's the fact that CNN covered his speeches.
Why did they do that?
Beginning to end for 6 months. Not because of Twitter, because they thought they were getting good ratings.
He was able to directly address people, and other politicians are. Twitter in its beginning, you know, when it helped facilitate and enable the Arab Spring and other kinds of early movements. And so it is important to have an unmediated, social media platform, whatever you want to call it, where people, good and bad, can talk directly. And then that gets picked up by existing channels. So,
no disagreement with that.
I would lament the end of Twitter, especially if the future looks like something like Mastodon. And this is something where a bunch of journalists are saying everybody's leaving Twitter and going to Mastodon. Simply not true. And when you look at the way that Mastodon or decentralized social media platforms operate, they're not going to be as influential because they don't have the same kind of reach. Weirdly, Twitter, you know, and Facebook to a certain degree, both of which are kind of fading. So that means they'll definitely be regulated because the government loves to regulate companies in their dying days. But they replace mass media not by having centralized networks or nodes that distribute stuff that you can't get away from or you have to watch when they're doing it, but by creating mass platforms where individuals can really route around all sorts of blockage and gatekeepers. And that's a real loss if that happens, whether it's because of Elon Musk or because of regulators.
But I think if anything, if we get rid of the disinformation teams or whatever at Twitter, that probably benefits the platform as a like dissemination point for, you know, movements that would otherwise be shut down or viewpoints that would otherwise be shut down. So I'm fine with that. I don't think that, like, if Twitter dies, it won't be because Musk fired the disinformation team.
I do not blame Twitter for Donald Trump becoming president. I blame Macaulay Culkin. Because if he hadn't been so damn cute in Home Alone 1, there wouldn't have been a Home Alone 2. And thus there wouldn't have been a Donald Trump cameo in Home Alone 2, making him a famous movie star, perpetuating the myth of Donald Trump that led to The Apprentice. You go back to 2016 and you see that The Apprentice Apprentice viewers actually formed like the molten core of Donald Trump's support for presidents. It was Macaulay Culkin and his cute kid actor face that gave us Donald Trump. And that's my story. The only feature I want to see, by the way, for Twitter, is that when someone is trending, like a famous person, especially an old person, anybody over 50, even 40, I want the trending tab to make clear that they're not dead, or that they are, I guess, if they are. Okay, let's go to our end of show, what you're watching, what you're consuming. Catherine, let's start with you.
Yes, I read a book called The Long Ships. It's by Franz Bentingsson. He's Swedish. The book was written in 1955, and it was sent to me as part of the, again, extremely welcome deluge of content after my scooter accident. By Andy Rotherham. You can see him in a video that we made a couple years ago about busing for charter schools. He's an ed policy dude. But upon hearing that I would not be making it to our lunch, he said, I'm going to send you a book. And this book has an introduction by Michael Chabon, where he basically says, I'm weirdly obsessed with this book and you're going to read it and you will be too. It is a faux Viking saga. So it was written in 1955, but it's set in the 10th century and has big kind of fake historical text energy, which I really enjoy. And it's great. It's like a, it's just like a wonderful, weird adventure story. It's what I kind of wanted Moby Dick to be. And yes, I know those are fighting words to a variety of, you know, Melville stands out there. Extra bonus points for the fact that when this book was published, its author refused to have it translated into German. Or earlier version of this book was published. Its author refused to have it translated into German. Why? Because fuck the Nazis. That's why. So just, you know, everything good in this book. A nice, long, absorbing work of historical fiction for those who think they might like that kind of thing. The Long Ships by Franz G. Bentingsson.
I like the idea of a faux Viking saga. It's like the pleather of Viking sagas.
Yes, that's right. It's just as shiny on the outside, but less murdery on the inside.
A little softer.
Why can't we actually do historical history? I mean, do we need another fake mythology to remember now?
I think fake mythologies are almost always better. I'm done with Norse mythology.
I don't want to learn about Thor and Marvel Comics or Game of Thrones.
You better learn to
fucking
love
the Shire and Tolkien.
You better learn to love Vikings, because in our current era of paranoia about cultural appropriation, Vikings are what white people have. We are going to get a lot more Viking media. That is one of my predictions, because it is not hashtag problematic for white people to dress up as Vikings, make movies about Vikings.
It's getting there with the cornrows and the hair extensions. It's getting problematic. But I don't consider myself white, and certainly not Viking white. You know, on the Irish side, my people were, you know, attacked by the Vikings, and on the Italian side, they were in southern Italy. They were conquered by everybody. So
there's a lot of praise for Irish women in this book, Nick.
Yeah, so. Obviously, they know not what they're talking of. But
The Northman was great, and God of War Ragnarok is getting great reviews. Haven't played it yet, Eric. What have you been consuming?
Yeah. On the other hand, I just watched the fourth Thor movie last night, and boy. Like, that's not great. I hope our Viking media doesn't go that direction.
Need better Viking media, Elon Musk. Make that happen for us.
Yeah, that was a stinker. I've been consuming Being Funny in a Foreign Language. This is the relatively new, it came out last month, album from the 1975. I think it's their fifth full-length album, and I've always kind of been a fan of theirs, but this one, like, really just struck me and, like, grabbed on. You know, it scratched into my soul, which is, like, a hold steady line about when you really love songs. It's only, like, 45 minutes long, so honestly, everybody should just, like, put that on as soon as this podcast is over and listen to it, but I will recommend a couple tracks if you don't want to listen to the whole thing. Oh, Caroline is, like, a real banger. This is the one that if songs still make it on the radio from bands like the 1975, I don't know if they do, but this would be the one. Wintering sounds like an old Paul Simon song if you're into that sort of thing, but like filtered through Jack Antonoff. He helped produce this whole album. I'm a huge fan of his. You probably know him a bit from his work with like Taylor Swift and Lana Del Rey and Lorde, as well as his former band Fun and Bleachers. He's got his hands in like every single project that's happening in like alt music right now. The opening song and the closing song are both fantastic. The opener is called the 1975, somewhat confusingly, just like the name of the band. It's got this awesome little piano riff in it that is, I think, a deliberate nod to the LCD Sound System song All My Friends, which is is, there's no room for debate about this, the best LCD sound system song, number one, no doubt. And it's interesting because I think this is the little libertarian hook here, is that the whole album, and especially the first and last track, are kind of about like online culture and like bad tweets and your experience in your 20s when you're still sort of finding your place in the world and in online, especially. There's a line in the first song about, I'm sorry about my 20s. I was learning the ropes. I had a tendency of thinking about it after I spoke. We're experiencing life through the postmodern lens. Oh, call it like it is. And then that whole theme kind of comes back on the last track too, When We Are Together, which is also just like delicious and beautiful. It sits somewhere in like the Bon Iver to Phoebe Bridgers spectrum. And the fiddle bit on it in particular is really, really good. And sort of evocative of Moonsong from Phoebe Bridgers' last album, actually. And again, it sort of deals with this question of like cancel culture and online culture. Matty Healy, the lead singer of the 1975, sort of got canceled a little bit back during the Black Lives Matter protests for some things that he tweeted. He then subsequently deactivated his Twitter account, which makes him smarter than most of the rest of us on this podcast. And the resolution of all this tension throughout the album is that basically none of that bullshit online really matters, as long as you have like people that love you and Walmart toy departments. Yes, really, like capitalism and love are kind of the resolution at the end of the album. It is beautiful. Everyone should listen to it. Being Funny in a Foreign Language by the 1975.
So point number one, the best LCD sound system.
I knew you were going to argue about this.
The best LCD sound system song is Losing My Edge, and in particular, the live performance from their Goodbye show, which turned out not to actually be their last show, at the Madison Square Garden. But point number two, speaking of Madison Square Garden, have you been reading the coverage of the 1975's live shows to promote this album? Because apparently, the singer is doing things like eating huge chunks of raw meat on stage and miming touching himself in front of like giant videos of Ben Shapiro.
He's a weird dude. Makes good art, like, though, but weird dude.
Actually happening on stage. Anyway, it's apparently pretty nuts. Okay, so I'll go next here. I saw Black Panther Wakanda Forever. It is the sequel to Black Panther, which is one of the very best Marvel movies. Wakanda Forever is not one of the very best Marvel movies. It's ambitious, and at times it is shot through with some real emotion because it pays tribute to Chadwick Boseman, the star of Black Panther, who played the character Black Panther, and who died tragically in his early 40s of cancer before this movie could be made. The moments where the movie pays tribute to Chadwick Boseman, I think, largely work. But this is just an overstuffed, bloated kind of sort of Marvel movie in not quite the worst possible way, but in a lot of ways that just don't work. There's so much set up for other stuff. There's a whole long sort of side plot that's setting up the Ironheart television show, sort of, which is going to, you know, end up being the Ironheart television show. Ironheart is about a young woman who invents an Iron Man suit. Well, of course, she is going to. That, and then Ironheart will end up playing a role in Armor Wars, which was going to be a series, but now it's going to be a movie. And then there's this whole Julia Louise Dreyfus subplot where it's like she's married to the guy who was in the Hobbit movies, or was married to him. She's his ex-wife. And it's just like, this is a 2.5 hour movie, and 45 minutes of it are basically teasers for other Marvel stuff. And those teasers aren't all that interesting. And also, the movie kind of just looks like garbage. It's genuinely shocking how bad and like unartful, just sort of badly crafted, this $200 million film is. So there's some interesting ideas there, and I think the trio of lead performances, they basically took the supporting cast from the first Black Panther and put them at center stage. I think those performances are all quite good. It's not a total disaster. This movie is certainly better than something like the Eternals, which similar sort of bloated movie, the Marvel movie that came out.
It's
after
still
the
going on. The Eternals never really ended.
But like, think about the titles to both of these: The Eternals, Wakanda Forever. It's just like, these are, you know, comments on the running time, and I. It was a big disappointment. It really didn't work for me. And I say that as somebody who's a very big fan of the first film. So, Nick, let's end with you and tell us not only what you've been watching, but what we should watch out for that you have in store for us.
Okay. So, you know, there's the Reason Interview podcast, which comes out every Wednesday, and I'll start with that. The next one is with Andrew Koppelman, who wrote a book called Burning Down the House, which is a critique of libertarianism from mid-20th century to now. He essentially says that we've left Hayek behind and embraced Rothbard, and that's a problem. I agree with him in that large sweep of things, but we disagree on virtually everything else, including the anecdote that gives the title to his house. The other thing is, on December 1st in New York City, we're doing a Reason Speakeasy with Caitlin Bailey, who is the head of a group called Old Pros. It's a sex worker rights group. She's fantastic. She also does a one-woman show called Whore's Eye View, which is a comic but serious look at 10,000 years of prostitution. That's great. So that's coming up. Go to reason.com/events to see that, as well as Soho Forum events and anything else that's happening. What I watched, and I'll be brief because this is beautiful and perfect. I have been consuming Hanging with Dr. Z, which is the comedian Dana Gould, who has worked with everybody, was also on Seinfeld, did a great early web series called Murray Wilson, Rock and Roll Genius with Peter Bagg. Try and find that online. It's very funny. But he plays Dr. Zaius from Planet of the Apes as a 70s-styled late-night talk show host. If you liked Space Ghost Coast to Coast, this is a version of that on kind of psychedelics. It is funny. It's interesting. It is timeless. And
I think a lot of people would describe Space Ghost Coast to Coast as on psychedelics already. Yeah. Is this another level?
This is another level. It's extremely funny, even more self-referential. And I think, unlike learning false histories, what a show like Hanging with Dr. Z does is it is the last place you can go to remember a rapidly deteriorating and disappearing ephemeral culture of post-war television, late night television. I'll just say Hanging with Dr. Z, give it 15 minutes. It's free on YouTube. It's extremely funny, and it will make you want to know more about the past than you ever thought you wanted to.
All right. I will definitely do everyone a favor here and not end this show by doing my Zorak impression.
Oh,
Zorak,
very of course, nice. Is you have a keyboard?
The supervillain who was captured by Space Ghost and forced to play his band leader, and also the actual funniest thing I ever saw when I was 14. For a full year of my life, I was just kind of laughing, cackling hysterically because of the existence of Zorak. Huge cultural touchstone for me. All right, that's all the time we have for this week. Remember, if you like this podcast or others that Reason produces, you can give us money. Support Reason, support the Reason Roundtable at reason.com/donate. That's reason.com/donate. The Reason Roundtable will return in Thunderball.